for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Right, folks, this is Anti-War Radio, and I'm Scott Horton. My blog is thestressblog.com. All the news in the whole world is at antiwar.com. And good anti-government propaganda for the back of your car is at libertystickers.com, particularly there in the Scott Horton section. All right, this is Chaos Radio. As you guys all know, I'm big Ron Paul fan and have been since, 1996, 1997, somewhere around there. And I'm also very excited about his presidential campaign and knowing how many new people are being exposed to his message of non-interventionism in foreign affairs, non-interventionism in the economy, and non-interventionism in your personal life and mine. And, I'm just stoked beyond belief at how well the campaign is going so far and at how well Ron Paul is doing in it. And, of course, you know, I kind of kick myself for even being surprised at all. Try not to put too much hopes in anyone or anything to really do anything. But really, I should not be at all surprised to see the level to which Ron Paul has risen in order to accomplish this task, however exactly you define it, in his run for the presidency. So anyway, part of this, I think, is that every interview he's given has been better than the one before it, or at least every time he's gotten on TV, whether it's the Bill Maher or Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, those kinds of things, the Tucker Carlson show, and he's just doing great. And yet, he keeps topping himself every time. This is Ron Paul yesterday, the top story at the beginning of the hour on the Tucker Carlson show on MSNBC.
From Texas, Ron Paul. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tucker, and good to be with you.
So the conventional explanation for the problems between Israel and Palestine is partly anyway, the United States doesn't intervene enough, we're not engaged enough in the peace process. Do you buy that? Should we be engaged in that peace process?
Well, I don't think the fact that we're involved has caused the problem as much as I think they're naturally enemies and they're going to fight. They have been fighting for a long time and they're going to continue to fight. But I think our presence there doesn't do much good. It's not going to solve the problem. You know, it reminds me of that statement that Ronald Reagan made in his memoirs when he was explaining why he left Lebanon, you know, in the early 1980s. And he said the irrationality of the politics of that region made him change his policies there. And he brought the Marines home after, you know, and we left. But he just sort of threw up his arms and said it was beyond his ability to solve those problems.
But we take a side in the Israel-Palestinian conflict broadly. We send billions to Israel. We also send money to the Palestinians. Right. But essentially, we're on Israel's side. Most Americans think we ought to be. Do you think we ought to be?
I think we should be on the side of neutrality and friendship with everybody and not subsidize either side. I mean, in the Middle East, we're strong allies and we subsidize Israel, but we've been propping up the Saudi government for more than 50 years, since World War II. And it sort of fits my argument that intervention doesn't lend itself to a peaceful world, especially for us. We lose a lot of men and women now being killed and a lot of money being spent, and there's no more peace than if we weren't there. As a matter of fact, I think Israel would do quite well without us there. They'd probably have a peace treaty with Syria. They want to talk peace with Syria, and we interfere with that process and say, oh, no, you can't talk to the Syrians. So Israel would have a great incentive to work out agreements with some of its neighbors. Now, the Palestinian affair is a lot tougher than Syria, but I think they've worked out an agreement, of course, with our help with Egypt. But there would be a tremendous incentive for Israel to work with Syria, come up with it, work with the Arab League. So I don't think we add a whole lot to solving that problem over there.
A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll finds that 52% of Americans, more than half of Americans, want the Democrats to take over the White House in this upcoming election. Obviously, bad news for you as running as a Republican. Mm-hmm. But doesn't it speak to the larger trend that shows pretty clearly Americans want more from their government? They expect the government to do more for them than they expected, say, 15 years ago. Yeah. How do you reverse that trend?
Well, I think that's the real contest, because obviously the people that work for me and campaign for me want exactly the opposite. They want to get the government off their backs. And, 52% might want a Democratic president, but that doesn't sound all that strong. I mean, right now the Democratic Congress isn't rating very high. And that's a healthy sign that the American people are waking up and they're getting disgusted with what they're getting. So maybe they will come to realize that we need less government, not more government. If they're unhappy, we can hardly argue that we've had minimal government over these past 50 years. All we do is have the expansion of government. And that fits my argument that we have too much government. We need a lot less.
But your government is, as you just put it, you want government off our backs. You want government to stop interfering in people's lives. But isn't interference the natural consequence of government services? In other words, when someone does something for you, he's by definition interfering in your life. So if you want less government interference, you're going to get fewer government services. You're not going to have government-provided health care, for one thing.
Yeah, you know, this is the whole thing. When you get something from government, that's all they talk about. The politician brags about it, and the people who receive it, they feel good, unless the services don't arrive on time, like in Katrina. You know, the services didn't work out so well. So I think what we forget is are the people who have to pay. You know, there's the other half of the equation. Yes, the people who have to pay, and the young people, especially today, who are sick and tired of the mess and who are inheriting this debt and inheriting this war, they have to pay. So services always come with a cost, whether it's direct taxation, future taxation, borrowing, interest payments, or a debased currency, and
okay,
that is inflation.
Then would you be willing to say out loud into the camera that the people of New Orleans ought to be responsible for building their own city, that it's not the responsibility of the rest of the country?
Well, that's the way it was supposed to be originally under the Constitution. It's only very recent years, in the last 10, 15 years, that it became central economic planning from the federal government. It hasn't worked that well.
Would you support a return? I mean, I guess my point is, if you say something like that out loud, it is taken by most people as callous, as mean. But you'd be willing to endorse a system in which regions or cities or states are responsible for their own disaster relief, and the federal government just says, I'm sorry, we're not getting involved?
Well, I think it's calloused and mean to depend depend on the federal government to go down there and make a mess out of trying to save New Orleans. They did such a lousy job. So central economic planning doesn't work. It's sort of like saying, are you going to be mean and not be a socialist? Aren't you going to take care of poor people and starving people? Well, socialism doesn't work. Central economic planning doesn't work. And, you know, in the past, you know, a long time ago in the 1900, Galveston was wiped off the map. And they rebuilt and FEMA didn't exist. And the seawall that they built is still there. So it isn't like it wouldn't happen. It just may happen better, cheaper, and more efficiently instead of federal agents getting in the way, taking the guns from the people, not letting private owners get to their property. I get so many complaints about FEMA once we have an emergency in our district.
Well, you've been to a number, three or four Republican debates so far. What's it like backstage? Who do you like? Who, if you weren't voting for yourself, who would you vote for among the other 9 or 10 guys running?
Well, you know, I have a tough time because my philosophy is strict constitutionalist and anti-war and pro-free markets, and nobody quite fits that bill, and probably one of the reasons why I'm in this race. So it'd be very hard for me to get enthusiastic about anybody who's supporting this war and not reassessing it and making an effort to get our troops home and not supporting the idea that you don't go to war without declaring war and win them and get them over with and be more precise and put more responsibility on the Congress. So I'd have a hard time picking one of them right now.
Well, how about Giuliani? He's the front runner overwhelmingly, if you ask Republican primary voters. Would you vote for him?
I'd have a lot of trouble. I think he's an authoritarian. I think he would use government way out of proportion to what the Constitution...
He's an authoritarian? What do you mean by that?
That means he likes to use government force. I mean, he wouldn't mind using some of these laws that have been put on the books since 9/11, the Patriot Act and the rejection of habeas corpus. I think I sense that among the whole group, that they're quite willing. And, of course, you know, the other night we had this debate, or to a degree, a debate discussion on whether we would use a nuclear first strike against a country that has no nuclear weapons, that has not, you know, attacked us. And they're all for it. So that to me is difficult. And yet I feel comfortable as a Republican because I think I speak for traditional conservative Republicans and I defend the Constitution.
Ron Paul of Texas running for president. I appreciate coming on, Congressman. Thank you
very much.
U.S. troops.
You're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM. I'm Scott Horton, and our guest today, Warren Ritchie, returning, journalist from the Christian Science Monitor. Talked to him a couple of weeks ago. You might remember about the Padilla trial, and he's written a couple of new ones about developments in the case of Ali Salah Al-Mari, who's been sitting in the brig for 4 years. Welcome back to the show, Warren.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Okay, now, hopefully, if we get time, I can ask you to update us a little bit on the case of Jose Padilla, but let's start with these, dare I say, explosive developments in the case of Mr. Al-Mari. Do I have that right? He's been sitting in a U.S. naval brig for 4 years?
Yes, he has. Yeah, he's held as an enemy combatant. He's not, you know, the same place that Jose Padilla was held. He is not, like Padilla, a U.S. citizen, but he was in the United States legally on a valid student visa, and so his legal status is significant for his legal status.
Mm-hmm. That he was arrested on American soil as opposed to captured in Afghanistan or something.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, he wasn't just arrested in the United States. He was arrested in Peoria, right?
Well, yeah, Peoria's in the U.S.
Well, I kind of think that matters a little bit as far as the narrative goes in the media, no offense, mm-hmm. but the fact that this, terrorists in Peoria, which is the kind of the Norman Rockwell painting, right?
That's right. It's the quintessential place. It's considered sort of the ultimate example of middle America.
So, right.
Yeah, that's right. There's some symbolism there, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sort of like in the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, vulnerable in the heartland of America where this kind of thing could never happen, and yet it did. That kind of thing gets a lot of play.
I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess.
All right. And now, really, the reason I wanted to harp on the Peoria thing just right there at the beginning is, especially as I'm reading your articles today, I've always wondered, what was it that this Al-Mari guy did anyway? And it says in your article that the accusations against him is that he was going to wage a cyber war against American financial markets.
Yeah, that's the allegation.
I mean, pardon me if that sounds like it's not true on its face.
Well, I don't know. It's very difficult to know, to gauge whether or not a particular individual would be capable of carrying something like that out. That is the allegation that he was, and he did come to the United States to study at, I believe, Bradley University there in Illinois, computer science. And mm-hmm. so he does have some skill with computers, but it's a little unclear how exactly he was going to wage an assault, a computer assault on financial markets. But that is the allegation. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some other the central allegation was that he was sent to the United States to be a kind of sleeper agent of Al-Qaeda, and that he had contacts with Al-Qaeda members. Those are difficult to assess as well, but the suggestion was that he was sent to the United States by senior members of Al-Qaeda to engage in some kind of an attack at a later date.
Difficult to assess. Is that because there's been no evidence put forward to sustain that, or what?
Well, the administration has submitted affidavits saying that they have evidence of this, but it's not quite clear because he's not been put on trial and he's not in a criminal setting, so there isn't the same kind of adversarial system or hearing to test the veracity of these allegations.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the administration has put up evidence. It's just not clear how reliable the evidence is, so we're kind of left with that. But it has been enough to convince a magistrate and a judge that he should be held
mm-hmm.
as an enemy combatant in military detention. Now, of course, as you know, this week the Fourth Circuit Federal Appeals Court overturned that ruling and ordered his release because they said that he was that the president had overstepped his authority in ordering him to be held as a by the military as opposed to being charged by a crime or being held for some kind of immigration violation or something else.
Now, when the Military Commissions Act was passed last fall, didn't it say in it, by the way, federal courts, you're not allowed to hear cases deciding whether we have the power to do this kind of thing?
It did, and that's one of the really interesting aspects of this this decision, because when the when lawyers for Almari went to court and launched this constitutional challenge, you know, they argued in effect that the president didn't was acting outside his authority, and that that if someone who's in the United States legally is to be detained, they must be detained under the same legal regime that that normally is under. You'd need to go in front of a judge, and they'd need to show some evidence, and there'd be an opportunity to test it, as opposed to just declaring someone an enemy combatant and placing them into military custody. When this suit came up to the appeals court level, an important thing had happened in the meantime. The Military Commissions Act was passed by Congress, and so the administration argued that the appeals court, even though the lower court had ruled on this and ruled in favor of detaining him militarily, the appeals court did not have jurisdiction to hear this case because of the Military Commissions Act, which had stripped it of jurisdiction. And so this was a test, and it was not an insignificant test, because at the time that the Military Commissions Act was passed, you know, the primary focus of the Military Commissions Act was the individuals being held at Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, major court battles over to what extent individuals there should be allowed due process, access for due process to federal judges in the United States. This is all over the habeas corpus rights and what rights are due to those individuals. Well, the Military Commissions Act is written it doesn't just say this only applies to people at Guantanamo. It also applied to any non-citizen who is designated as an enemy combatant. And so the question was, well, Almari is a non-citizen, but he was arrested in the U.S. and he was legally present in the U.S. And in addition, he also has a family and wife and was presumably in the United States to study. And so the question is, well, what kind of rights should he have? And did the Military Commissions Act strip courts in the United States of the ability to hear a case by someone who is in the United States legally and has some kind of tie to the United States, legitimate tie to the United States? This court said that the Military Commissions Act does not apply to a person in Almari's position.
Okay, now, so what that means, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if you're a lawyer in a past life or anything like that. I don't have any legal training, but I really want to understand this. My basic understanding, I guess, is that when the Military Commissions Act says to a federal court that you may not review the standing of this law, et cetera, like that, that the only excuse that they have, the only way that they can ignore that, basically, and rule against it anyway, is if they're not quibbling over the statute, but over the Constitution. And when they say that the constitutional law is being violated by this statute, then they can basically ignore Congress's mandate that they not take these cases and decide something like this. Is that basically right?
Well, first, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a reporter. But I write about the law quite a bit. But it's not, that's not exactly how I understand it. The way I think about this decision that came down, there are three big issues. Two of them deal with constitutional rights, due process rights. That's sort of the merit side of the decision. But the first question that the court has to address is whether it has jurisdiction to hear the case. And that's what I was talking about earlier. The Military Commissions Act essentially says that courts don't have jurisdiction to hear cases, habeas cases, or other challenges to detention by people who have been, and let me be specific here, by non-citizens who have been, are being detained as enemy combatants. Now, that primarily means people in Guantanamo, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't have been somebody who was not a citizen who's detained in the United States. And so there was great concern, and still is, that the Military Commissions Act could apply to any non-citizen deemed an enemy combatant and essentially held by the military.
But haven't they argued in the past that it was okay that they were doing what they were doing because Guantanamo was not the United States?
Yes, and these are individuals who have never come to the United States, who have never come onto American soil, because there's a difference between the rights that you are due when you're in the United States versus someone who's overseas. And the administration has paid close attention to this. And in a series of rulings in recent years, the Supreme Court has kind of cut back on that. And you may recall, you know, there was a ruling several years ago in a case called Rasul that said that the prisoners at Guantanamo may be due some rights, to appeal to federal courts. But interestingly, those rights are statutory rights, and I'm probably getting too deep into this, but there's a difference between a statutory right, a right that comes from a law written by Congress, versus a constitutional right.
Yeah, see, that's what I was trying to get at, too.
Yes. And so the constitutional right, and this is a somewhat murky area right now, because there are arguments that what was done in the Military Commissions Act was a kind of suspension of the constitutional right of habeas corpus. And if Congress, through the Military Commissions Act, has suspended habeas corpus without the conditions that are laid out in the Constitution, that there be an emergency situation that requires it.
An invasion or rebellion, the Constitution
says.
Right.
Yeah, then that's unconstitutional, and they can't do it. But the administration perspective on that is that these are statutory rights that are implicated at Guantanamo, and that the Military Commissions Act relates to those statutory rights, not to the constitutional right to habeas. Now, when you're in the United States, there is a constitutional right to habeas, particularly if you're a legal resident. And so the Fourth Circuit said that if the Military Commissions Act applied and stripped the courts of jurisdiction in the Almari case, that would amount to a suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, and that would be a violation of the Constitution. So it essentially said that they did have jurisdiction, and that part of the decision significantly was 3-0. It was unanimous.
And didn't you quote the the opinion as going back to the Civil War and saying the president just does not have the authority to use the military against Americans unless there is a declared state of martial law or a declared by Congress suspension of the writ of habeas corpus.
Yeah, the majority in the Fourth Circuit case went back to the Milligan case that is a significant landmark, and essentially that case says that if the courts are open and functioning, then the military doesn't have jurisdiction to take control or seize civilians. That civilians, if they are to be held, they must be held in the civilian process. This is the essence of the debate going on in the country now. It's whether or not this war on terror is substantially different than anything we've faced in the past, and thus we need a new legal paradigm to deal with it. That legal paradigm recognizes that there are no boundaries when you are fighting. There is no defined battlefield when you're fighting an enemy that is prepared to load up the trunk of a car with explosives and drive it into a place where there are a lot of innocent people.
And that's what the government has argued, right, in court, that the whole world is the battlefield, including the United States. And now you're saying that the court said,
That's right. That's right. The court here said that can't be, that isn't the correct interpretation, that if you want to hold someone as you're holding Almari, you have to charge him with a crime. And if you don't charge him with a crime, then you have to do something else. Now, the something else could be, a lot of the commentary about this decision has sort of presented it as an either-or situation. Well, you either charge him with a crime or you let him go. Well, that's not true. There are a lot of things the government could do to hold someone if they really thought they were dangerous. They could use the material witness, material witness warrant, for example, which was used widely in the weeks and months after the 9/11 attack for this broad dragnet that was conducted throughout the country. Anyone who was suspected of any kind of connection to Al-Qaeda was brought in and interrogated.
Thousands of people, right?
That's correct. Yeah. And that was all done using a material witness warrant.
That's funny, isn't it? That one's really gone down the memory hole. I think most people just don't remember that. It's been burned away.
And there are other things that can be done. They could move Almari to Guantanamo, for example. Now, it was
didn't a group of judges down in Guantanamo just declare that they didn't have jurisdiction over these guys anymore because of whether the combatants were lawful or unlawful?
Well, stay tuned on that. The government is appealing. And that decision is interesting in that in watching this process for over the years, there's never really been a question about people who are held at Guantanamo. They've always been they've been referred to as enemy combatants, but the government's view, the Defense Department's view of those individuals were that they were unlawful enemy combatants all the time. In other words, they've used the term enemy combatant as a kind of shorthand, but what they meant was unlawful enemy combatant. Now,
I thought that unlawful enemy combatant was all defined in the Geneva Conventions and all that, and what they did instead was make up this brand new thing out of whole cloth, that the enemy combatant that existed nowhere in the law, so that they didn't have to obey all the statutes that enforced the Geneva Conventions.
Well, they were trying to avoid common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, and essentially what they said was that these people are as unlawful combatants, they're not entitled to the protections of the Geneva Convention. And this is the tricky thing. If the administration believed that some of the individuals at Guantanamo were lawful enemy combatants, then by holding them at Guantanamo, they are clearly in violation of Geneva, right? Because a lawful enemy combatant must be treated as a POW, and they can't do a lot of the things that are happening at Guantanamo. They just can't do that. And so if there was someone that the military thought was a lawful enemy combatant, that individual would have to be treated in a different way and have to be in a different location. So I'm not, I hesitate to predict what happens, but I suspect the administration might win its appeal. They've asked both judges to reconsider, and in their motions to reconsider, they've essentially said that the enemy combatant designations by the Combat Status Review Tribunals amount to a finding that they are unlawful enemy combatants. Pretty much what I just said. But we'll see. Maybe the judges disagree, and then the administration would have to appeal it to a three-judge panel.
Well, it's hard for me to believe that all this kind of making it up as they go along could possibly be, you know, ultimately legal and constitutional. I mean, we're so far beyond constitutional here. We're talking details within unconstitutional behavior, right?
Well, yes, they are.
I have the Bill of Rights here, and the Bill of Rights doesn't say citizen anywhere. It says people, persons, et cetera, as vague as possible, deliberately. You can't go around doing this to people, is what it says, basically.
Well, there are several different places where they talk about the people, and there are places where it designates.
What? It doesn't say Americans or citizens or anything. The implication is anyone under the jurisdiction of the national government of the United States. I mean, Congress does have the power to make rules concerning the laws of war and dealing with foreigners and foreign states and that kind of thing. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But anyone under their jurisdiction here, anyone under the power of the federal police here is supposed to be bound by the Bill of Rights. Unlike this guy Almari, who was thrown in a dungeon, or Padilla.
Yes. Well, the administration position is that in under emergency circumstances, the executive has the power to take action to protect the country, and they cite cases that support that proposition. I mean, this isn't resolved yet, and it is. It's a difficult area because the stakes are so high for the country. For example, this Fourth Circuit decision will be appealed, and the Fourth Circuit, it's not clear how the Fourth Circuit will rule on this. It's a close case because the judges are, at least analysts believe the judges will be pretty sharply divided. And so one or two judges may swing this one way or the other. And then after that, it's unclear what happens at the United States Supreme Court, if it should go there and if the Supreme Court should agree to hear it. It's just not clear how these cases will be resolved and whether or not the court will recognize this kind of power for the president.
Well, it has been a kind of a roller coaster ride, actually, you know, over the last few years, watching these different court cases, and trying to really make sense, trying to find a pattern. I'm no mathematician. Maybe if I had a bit higher IQ, I could see the pattern in here somewhere. But from where I sit, it seems completely random whether somebody's going to get thrown in Guantanamo or whether they're going to be imprisoned in Eastern Europe at former Soviet gulags, or whether they'll be given a trial like Moussaoui and John Walker Lind, or maybe held by the Navy and tortured for a while and then given a trial, like Jose Padilla. Is there a pattern to any of this?
Well, I think part of it is where you are arrested, where you're seized. If you're seized overseas, then you're going to be dealt with overseas. If you're arrested in the U.S. like Moussaoui was, you know, and brought into the criminal justice system, then that's where you're where.
No, because that's what happened to Padilla. They turned him over to the Navy. And then you had Yasser Hamdi, who was arrested on the same battlefield with John Walker Lynn. They held him as an enemy combatant for a while, then they let him go.
Well, what happened with Hamdi is they discovered while he was at Gitmo that he was born in the United States. So
right.
He was a citizen. And so here's an example of the sort of the benefit of citizenship. So instead of being at Gitmo, he is then brought to the United States and held at the brig. Now, that did trigger all kinds of judicial review that hasn't been accorded to the prisoners at Guantanamo. And at the end of that review, I think it is telling that at the end of that review, when he essentially won his case, rather than getting his hearing that he was fighting for, he was allowed to return to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And so there never was a hearing.
Right.
There's a lot of that.
How many people have been released from Guantanamo Bay over the years? Just sent back, basically.
Oh, I don't know the number, but it's probably, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking 200 or 300.
But there's a danger in looking at in seeing that and saying, well, those were individuals who were all innocent.
Really?
Yeah, there is actually. Now I think it's clear that some people who have been detained and some who are still there are most likely innocent, were picked up under, you know, wrong, under false evidence or however.
But sold by the Pakistanis or the Northern Alliance.
That's right. There was a bounty system, and if you brought in somebody who was Al-Qaeda, you got paid a certain amount. And so you can see that how, you know, in the aftermath of, you know, with U.S. military operations underway, and you put out word that, you know, we'll pay you X number of dollars if you can bring us somebody from Al-Qaeda. Well, you can imagine what would happen because that's whatever it was a lot of money. And so it was incumbent on the United States to, you know, be extraordinarily careful. And we were told that the individuals who would make it to Guantanamo would be the worst of the worst. Now, that doesn't seem to have been the case, but that doesn't mean that some of them aren't.
Oh, right. Now, I wasn't trying to argue that everyone there is innocent. I was referring to I thought you were referring to the ones who were let free.
Well, yeah, well, now...
Talk about not being proven beyond a shadow of doubt and presumption of innocence. I got to presume anybody that they let go after a few years of telling us that they're the worst of the worst must have been innocent all along, or else why would they let them go?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, but from looking at the process, they don't actually declare that the individuals are sort of safe to go, and many of them have not. Many of them are still locked up. They're just locked up in their home country. When they're sent back, you know, some of them do go free, but many of them go right into a cell in their home country.
Mm-hmm. Which actually, don't say that too loudly, because you could just reveal a real simple solution to this problem.
Well, you know, the military officials have said this, that if they could find places for a lot of these individuals, they would, and then they could eliminate the need for Guantanamo. But
Well, the Egyptians and the Syrians and others have already been torturing people for us, the renditioning and all that. You know, send them there. I mean, there are any number of American client states overseas that aren't run by any system of law whatsoever.
Mm. Well, yeah. Of course, we have, you know, the United States has laws that prevent that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well,
I'm wondering. I'm looking for the law which prevents them from doing anything. I admit I am very impressed to see courts here and there stepping up and limiting this power. I essentially, last summer, the Supreme Court ruled that Bush had been violating the law all along.
And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
Yeah, babe.
And so, you know, that was basically the argument of the Bush administration. The Geneva Convention was too vague. No degrading behavior of any kind. Can you be more specific? And so they were breaking the law all along. I don't know how many different charges of kidnapping and torture and murder you would put on them. But basically the Supreme Court said that this entire system, as it existed from the beginning of the war against Afghanistan up until that point, was completely without legal basis whatsoever, and that Bush could not continue to do any of this unless Congress passed a law making it legal, which they immediately did.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons this designation of enemy combatant versus illegal enemy combatant is or unlawful enemy combatant is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Because if these individuals or any of these individuals are not unlawful enemy combatants, then there's no, then they're acting in clear violation of the Geneva Accords. And so we shall see. But
Let me ask you this in the last few minutes here. Can you give us an update on the case of Jose Padilla? Has there been any interesting developments at his trial lately?
Well, my understanding now, I have to sort of full disclosure. I'm in Washington D.C. working on other things, but I'm keeping an eye on the trial. And
They're
at this point, they are, the government has completed its direct examination of the case agent, the FBI case agent, which means that they have gone through many of the, they have played for the jury many of the tapes, the intercepted conversations of the defendants, Adham Hassoun, Jayusi, and Padilla. And now the defense is beginning cross-examination, which should be interesting because the, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the tapes is that they seem to show a kind of loose code that was used by individuals talking on the phone. And the FBI agent says, well, this is, you know, when they're talking about soccer, they're really talking about, you know, jihad and fighting. And when they're talking about sports equipment, they're really talking about weaponry. And there's one particular, I haven't seen it yet, but there's one particular reference to sending zucchini to Lebanon. And, you know, it's a large amount of money to buy zucchini. So we'll see what that means. But the defense has said that the FBI is putting a sort of spin on this.
Is there any way for them to prove, or have they really attempted to prove that zucchini means this, or just that obviously they weren't talking about zucchini and just trying to say, make up your own conclusion, or what?
Yeah, well, we'll see. We have to, you know.
So far, they haven't.
So far, I haven't seen it.
Okay.
But you know, the jury is sitting there listening to this, and so the jury is going to use its common sense. So even if the government doesn't bring something in and say, okay, well, here's what they were talking about, I mean, as an observer of the trial, that's what I'd like to see that, because I'd like to know, And from the defense, I'd like to know what it is that they were talking about, if there's an innocent explanation.
Or even a less guilty explanation, such as they were just scoring some hash from Lebanon. It wasn't, you know, I mean, or any number of who knows what. Maybe it really was soccer balls, or I don't know. I think people talk in kind of phony code about things all the time on the phone. And if you're an FBI agent, you can have a lot of fun imagining what they must have really meant by that and see how it all fits together. And you know how FBI agents are. They're kind of conspiracy theorists. They start with their conclusion and then they work backwards to try to make it look like they're right.
Well, yes, that's true. And that, of course, that's their job. They're there to make cases. But there is an aspect of, you know, in the Middle East, and I don't know if how much you've traveled in the Middle East, but...
Not at all.
Governments in the Middle East aren't as free as we Americans might be accustomed to. But people who live in the Middle East know that it's not uncommon that the government is listening and or watching. And so this kind of, there is a kind of code or reluctance to speak that could be related to that, as opposed to a concern about people listening on this side. But there is some indication in these conversations that the individuals were concerned about American agents listening in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be, you know, it's not a clear picture at all.
Well, you know, it's obvious that I have a bias of, you know, the most presumption of innocence that I can conjure up in my mind for these three, because the whole case against Jose Padilla before this was complete bull. And then, as you explained to us last time, these other two guys, the feds have been watching them for 15 years, and only now they've decided to prosecute them. Paul Wolfowitz said that Padilla wasn't guilty of anything other than some fairly loose talk, which means to me that this whole thing is a sham. And besides that, even if he's guilty, the fact that the U.S. government tortured him in his Navy dungeon means to me that he gets set free anyway. So that's my bias against this. I give these guys the biggest presumption of innocence that I can possibly conjure up. And I very well may be wrong about that. It very well could be that these guys really are guilty of, you know, trying to arrange some money for some Chechen fighters or whatever it is they're accused of. But it just seems to me like... Well, it's, you know, it's sort of like the Almari case, right? This was kind of a big deal, sort of like the JFK plot and the Fort Dix plot before that. Real big deal on TV for a little while, but then you don't hear anything about it anymore. Now we have a little bit of hindsight. We look back at Almari and we say, wait a minute, this guy is sitting in a library at the community college working on his PC, and all of a sudden he's a terrorist mastermind going to wage war against all the banks on Wall Street and destroy America's financial networks, et cetera, and whisk them off to a dungeon. And we look, to me, I look back on that now, and I hear that, and it just sounds like the most implausible. I don't even think they'd use that on 24 as an excuse to torture somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
I don't want to defend anybody or anything, but in this climate, with the possibility of a substantial bomb or a weapon of mass destruction, it's dangerous not to pay close attention to each individual. But having said that, it strikes me that it's dangerous to also be so consumed with this quest for security that you sort of treat people as if they're guilty. I mean, you said earlier presumption of innocence. In the United States, we're entitled to a presumption of innocence, and that should be the starting point. But
instead, I have to admit that that's my bias, right?
Well, yeah, that's not a bias. That's the requirement. That's our society. That's what we're about. And Mr. Almari doesn't seem to have had much of a presumption of innocence, nor Padilla. You know, when the Padilla trial started, the jurors had to be asked whether they'd ever heard the term dirty bomb. And now how do you unring that bell?
Right. Yeah, how prejudicial is just that question in the screening?
Yep. So, you know, I don't know what to say, but I think it's important to keep a close eye on these developments, and I think we're at a very important point as a country, because the other thing to remember is these issues are being worked out. When the appeals court ruled earlier this week, I mean, that's our system. That's the way it works. It
right.
will be appealed to a higher court, and that higher court is going to take a good, close look at this. They are going to do their best to decide what's the correct way to resolve it. And so our system is working. It sometimes it's frustrating because it doesn't work as quickly as maybe we'd like, but it is working.
Well, it's true. I have to give James Madison credit myself. I remember a clip out of that movie Amistad about the slave ship a long time ago. Remember that?
Sure, sure.
And there's a scene where the Spanish ambassador says to the president, "Well, why don't you just call the judge and tell him to rule the way you want?" And the president says, "I'm sorry, I really don't have any jurisdiction over the judges other than, you know, I gave him his job and hopefully he'll rule the way I want because I hired him. But other than that, I can't tell him how to decide." And the Spanish ambassador says, "Well, how the hell do you effectively rule this country if you can't just call the judges and tell them what to rule?" And you know, of course, the concern is now that the president basically is taking the position. See, in the movie, John Quincy Adams says, "Well, you know, we decided that liberty is more important than effective rule." And yet here, George Bush has taken the position of the Spanish ambassador to the United States back then, which is, screw the courts. I want to do this my way. And I guess I believe it's only because his approval rating is so low that he didn't just pull an Andrew Jackson and tell the Supreme Court to go screw themselves last summer. You know, why not? You made the law. Now let's see you enforce it. All right. That's what I thought. That's been the attitude of the Bush administration this whole time, and of course all this stuff is precedent setting. A President Giuliani is going to have all these laws that have been passed under Bush, only he'll have a fresh start. You know,
I have to point out, you know, these are fairly close issues. When the Supreme Court ruled, you know, it rules 5-4,
mm-hmm.
These are all close issues. So if one justice goes one way, then it goes the other way. So when the administration loses a close case, it loses a close case. These aren't 9-0 decisions. These
right.
are difficult, really difficult constitutional issues. This is in what we've seen over the past since 9/11 is really a kind of reexamination of some of the fundamental values of the country. I mean, really, when you look at some of the decisions and what the justices and judges are considering, this is bedrock stuff. You mentioned Madison. I mean, it does. It goes back to Madison. It goes back to what the founders of the country intended in terms of liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And not just liberty. Liberty wasn't the only. They were also concerned with having a country that would be robust enough to sustain threats from abroad. And as you know from early history of the country, we had major threats from abroad.
Yeah, the British invaded us twice.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right about that, and I think more and more people are understanding, and I wish more and more would too, that it can happen here. And this is the kind of thing where once you've given up your Bill of Rights, I mean, let's face it, the rule of men in this country, as it were, is doing everything it can to centralize power in the national government and in the presidency. And the only thing restraining them right now are Article 3 judges enforcing the Bill of Rights and the restrictions in Article 1, Section 9. That's it. The Constitution is the last barrier we have left to despotism in this country.
Yes, but I would turn it around the other way. Everything that happens in this country happens because of the Constitution. It's our foundation.
Right. It created Article 2 in the first place, right?
That's right. And so if the government goes off course, we have it there to pull it back. And that's the key. It's there. It's the foundation. And so it's not like it's going to go away. It's there. And And, you know, I think we just have to be confident that, you know, that the people in a position to enforce these protections enforce them.
Mm-hmm. If I could just keep you one more minute, I want to get your comment on this. One of my big fears when I look at the Padilla case and Omari and you know, you can go through the whole list from Lodi, California to Detroit and the Lackawanna Six and the Miami plot against the Sears Tower and the rest of these. It seems to me like the FBI is spending all their time making up nonsense cases to prosecute instead of doing their actual job, which is preventing the next actual spectacular attack planned by the people who actually plan to carry one out.
Well, it's, you know, if you look, I mean, I can understand how you could come to that conclusion, but in fact,
that's kind of how September 11th happened, right? Is they were sitting there jerking around doing everything but looking at Arabs and flight schools and the things that mattered.
Yes, but the efforts of the government have disrupted some plots. And if you want to criticize the government, you can criticize the government for being too aggressive. But what a lot of this is oriented toward is putting individuals who might be inclined to assist Al-Qaeda on notice. And I mean that in a broad way. Anybody who was inclined to contribute to a Muslim charity, even a legitimate Muslim charity, will not do so now because of the threat that they will, you know, they'll get the knock at the door and be hauled off to jail.
Well, see, I guess that's a really good point. It seems to me that if you look at the Miami case or the Fort Dix Six and all this stuff, if the FBI had just come to them and said, "Hey, pal, we're watching you, so don't get any smart ideas," rather than going to the lengths of hiring an informant and entrapping these people into these gigantic nonsense plots, if they would just put the people on notice that they're being watched and leave it at that, and meanwhile keep a lookout for real threats. I mean, there's a lot of entrapment going on, and you're right that they're being too aggressive, or if that's a criticism, that is one, I guess is what you said. But I'm saying they're not being aggressive towards, as far as I can tell, any actual threats since September 11th. It's all been, you know, the retarded kid down at the local Islamic bookstore that they entrap into saying something stupid into an open microphone.
Well,
like the New York case, the where he was going to set off a bomb at the subway station, where it's like, come on, this kid didn't do anything.
Well, there are cases. Well, in effect, the country has been put on notice.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who's paying attention knows that there is a massive eavesdropping operation underway, and so anybody who comes here or is here and wants to engage in this kind of activity is pretty much on notice that they're going to be watched and should be. If somebody comes here and wants to engage in illegal conduct in terrorism, then no, we better hope that the people who are sworn to protect us do so. The question is, are they doing so in a manner that complies with, you know, the other half of our constitutional protection? So,
Well, I'm definitely reassured in the case that somehow my computer crashes and I lose this file that I can call the NSA and get a backup recording of it. I appreciate your time very much. Everybody, Warren Ritchie is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, Warren.
Thank you very much.
y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and yeah, this is also an antiwar.com thing, too. Almari. Hey, thank you, Fourth Circuit Court, for attempting to put the second article of the Constitution back in its place. Good luck with that. We'll see what happens in the appeals process. I want to thank Warren Ritchie very much. This guy's obviously a reporter, and no matter what crazy things I says, he sticks to the facts and does a good job. Christian Science Monitor, Warren Ritchie can read all his articles. Quite a few of them are about terrorism trials, military combatant status, Guantanamo Bay, and that sort of thing. And he writes with an in-depth understanding behind him. All right, the number here is 646-6446 in Austin, Texas, if anybody wants to call in. If you're from out of town, it's 512-646-6446. I'll be happy to take y'all's calls if you want. Here's one coming in already. I guess I'll save my little Scooter Libby rant for a couple of minutes here. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. This is Vineyard Saker.
Hey, how's it going, VS, sir?
It's going pretty good. I'm watching with amazement the events in Gaza, and I just can't believe this, you know, the empire screwed up the way it did.
Yeah, I know that, well, everybody, Vineyard Saker, he's a blogger at my blog, thestressblog.com, and it seems from what you've been blogging in the past couple of days that you have a pretty in-depth understanding of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict definitely a greater capacity on this matter than I do. So let me ask you some questions about how it got to this point.
Okay.
Do I remember right that George Bush and the Israelis had a policy that the Israelis did not have to make peace with the Fatah leadership until they were democratically elected? They had to have an election. They forced the election. And then secondly, am I right that during that time, the Israelis refused to turn over all the tax money they had collected to the Palestinian Authority so that Fatah was completely unable to buy the votes that they needed to buy, that they were waging basically the war against Yasser Arafat and isolating him, surrounding his headquarters with military and that kind of thing, and then throwing this election that basically just handed the whole situation to Hamas. And then they decided that, oh, well, we don't care if you're democratically elected or not. If you're Hamas, then we can't have peace with you either. Is this stupidity, or is this a little piece of a longer-term strategy, or what the hell is going on over there?
Well, it's hard to tell, but my best guess is that this is actually, yeah, that's stupidity. I don't think this is a well-thought-through plan at all. And the takeover in Gaza... it's just another proof of that. I mean, it's a huge intelligence foobar. I'm amazed that more people didn't seize on that, you know, everybody seemed to be very surprised by what happened.
Right.
If you look, intelligence goes through three main phases. One is acquisition, that is getting the intelligence itself, the info. You can use drones, intercepts, agents on the ground, recon units, whatever. The second phase is called analysis. We make sense of the info, you make predictions and recommendations. The third is acceptance. You know, the getting of the national authorities to listen and act. Well, if you look at that case, in Gaza, you know, it's 130 square miles only. It's really small. It's completely surrounded by the Israelis. There's no way the acquisition did not work out. And, you know, they couldn't target and monitor what was going on. So either it's analysis, and they're just wrong in the way they understood the events, or it's acceptance, and they're not making their case. Screw-up. I mean, they're just stupid the way they let that happen, because now Israel is in a horrible position.
Well, and they're telling the New York Times that, we decided to let this happen, right?
Well, that's crap. I mean, that's just no way. Think about this, just a very simple thing. What are the options for Israel now?
Wait, let me stop you.
Okay.
What about all that I said about how the election was thrown and how it basically handed the whole thing to Hamas? I mean, was that a semi-accurate description of the lead-up to this?
No, it was actually pretty accurate, except for the real sanctions and the holding on taxes really happened after the election, as far as I remember. But yeah, they really demanded elections, and they got Hamas, in power there.
Yeah, the way I remembered it was...
you know, by pumping money into Fatah, et cetera, their bet was, you know, that Fatah would be having, you know, quote-unquote democratic legitimacy and just didn't go their way. Same thing happened in Algeria.
Right. Now, Lieberman, Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, of course,
yeah.
on Face the Nation Sunday said in part of his accusation against Iran that Iran backs our enemies, Hamas, against our allies, Fatah.
What a bunch of crap.
And I thought America or Israel, I don't know, it's hard to tell when Joe Lieberman's talking about who we are, but is anybody allies with Fatah?
Well, the Iranians give them, you know, moral support. I mean, everybody hates Fatah, let's put it this way. So as long as you're against Fatah and you're basically patriotic, the way Hamas is, you will find Shias such as Hezbollah, Sheikh Fadlallah, or the Iranians giving them support. That does not translate into weapon shipments and IEDs and stuff like this entering into Israeli-controlled Gaza Strip to explain what happened. I mean, the support is purely moral. And blaming it on Iran, or, you know, as I've seen this morning, an article saying that Al-Qaeda is now, you know, responsible for what happened in the Gaza Strip, it's just garbage.
Yeah, I saw that. You posted a link to that article on thestressblog.com.
Yeah.
And, yeah, talk about unbelievable. It was a bit too easy to imagine the goofballs sitting there making it up as they wrote it. You know, maybe that's just me. I'm a little bit more cynical than the next guy. But, and you know, I have a basic understanding that I've learned from Dr. Robert Pape. I think he's a doctor anyway. Professor Robert Pape, the author of Dying to Win.
Yeah, he's very good.
That though Hamas, rhetorically at least, sometimes supports Al-Qaeda and vice versa, never has Al-Qaeda struck Tel Aviv and never has Hamas taken part in attacks against the United States. They share weapons and training sometimes, but never targets these different terrorist groups. They're always focused on the enemy that they are focused on, with very little cooperation when it comes to that kind of thing.
Well, they have things in common. I mean, their faith, for one thing. There's definitely a Salafi component to Hamas's ideology, but Al-Qaeda is essentially Wahhabi Saudi. They care about, you know, the two holy cities, getting the infidels out. Hamas is really a local Palestinian phenomenon. It's quite different. So they do, of course, they support each other, at least ideologically. But that does not make it one organized entity that acts together. Absolutely not.
Now, isn't it the case that the Israeli government actually created Hamas in the first place as a counter to the people Joe Lieberman calls our allies, the Fatah guys?
Absolutely. But it's also Israeli policies in the Lebanon that created Hezbollah as a split-off from Amal at that time.
Right. Now, that was as a consequence rather than a deliberate plan to do so.
Correct.
In that case.
Correct.
But in either case, policy creating new enemies.
Yep.
Now, I don't understand. I guess, is this whole thing, is this still somebody acting out the clean break, the clean break plan of David Woomser and the guys from 1996, or are they just trying to, you know, clean up the mess that's created? It seems to me, just in, you know, kind of basic common sense, if I go into a neighborhood and say, well, you know, this used to be my grandfather's house, kill the people who live in it or throw them out at gunpoint and occupy that house and then proceed to go around bullying all my neighbors and threatening them, that's really not a good way to secure long-term peace in my neighborhood. And, you know, it's not a good way to guarantee that I'm going to be able to continue living my life without more trouble and blowback from them. It seems like the obvious policy for the government of Israel would be to try their very best to shake hands and make up with all their neighbors rather than, you know, continuing this seemingly unending process of occupation and low-intensity warfare for decades. I mean, what the hell?
Well, but keep in mind that the neocons and the likes of Lieberman are not long-term thinking people. I mean, they're driven by ideology, and it used to work in the past. I remember once Robert Fisk wrote in an article that when the Israelis crossed the border into Lebanon, you know, the Palestinians jumped in their cars and ran away from the combat, and now it's the opposite. When the Israelis cross the border, the Arabs in Beirut jump in their cars and drive south to fight the Israelis. When the secular Baathists and, you know, the social communists or whatever were opponents of Israel, that kind of approach worked. Now they're dealing with a completely different phenomenon, which is religious, deeply committed religious Arabs who are willing to actually slug it out and fight hard. And they're not afraid of them. And that strategy now doesn't work, but what else can they do? They don't have much of a good option. And they don't have much of a long-term plan at all. Neither does Israel have any long-term plan that, you know, has a conceivable success strategy, you know, outcome in the Gaza Strip or the U.S. and Iraq, et cetera. It's the same thing. It's,
well,
the
it's
French call
be.
It the fuite en avant. They're running forward, doing more of the same while trying to deny politically trying to protect their butts by saying, you know, we're going to do more and this is going to work. But it's not going to work.
Well, so what's going to happen now that... I mean, assuming that the secular communist types, the Fatah PLO types, are, you know, completely done, basically, have lost their authority in the Gaza Strip, what's the future? We're going to see reinvasion and reoccupation of Gaza by Israel, or is the whole thing going to turn into escape from New York, you know, prison by the sea, or what?
Well, I've just seen that they appointed Barak again, Minister of Defense. Which is certainly a step better than Peretz, who was just a terminal idiot. Sort of, they're doing the same thing as the U.S. did. You know, they got rid of Rumsfeld, put Gates in. But does it change their options? Not really. Reoccupying, well, they can do it. They can certainly enter. But, you know, you don't want to engage in a military operation where your entry is easier to understand than how you're going to exit. There's no exit strategy. I mean, what would be the point of reoccupying the Gaza Strip? It just makes no sense.
Yeah, well, but, I mean, aren't they... Do they have a real problem if there's a monopoly on control of Gaza and it's in the hands of Hamas?
Yes, they do.
I mean...
And the real problem... Okay, let me just go through the two other options. Get the UN or the Arab League to go in or control the border, as Foreign Minister of Israel said this morning. That isn't going to work either. It's not going to change anything on the ground. And as soon as you get any Arab country involved, there's real danger of collusion, weapons coming in, and, you know, it's not going to work either. And do nothing is the worst of all options, because you keep in mind there's one very important thing to realize here. If Hamas remains in control of the Gaza Strip, it's going to be the first time that the Palestinians actually liberated their own land. It's forcibly liberated Palestinian territory. They negotiated nothing for the Israeli withdrawal, and now they're negotiating nothing and getting rid of Fatah, which are basically Israeli stooges. That's going to send a tremendous message to the rest of the region. First time, it was Hezbollah who showed that they don't fear Israel. This time, it's Fatah doing the same thing, going, we're not afraid of you guys. So
right, well,
I really don't see a good option for
that. At the same time that America's being defeated in Iraq next
Absolutely.
Door.
Absolutely. Yeah. And all the, what I call, you know, the studios of the Imperial High Command. You look at Karzai, you know, he's in deep trouble. Malaki in deep trouble. Signora in deep trouble. Abbas in deep trouble. They're all sinking. And it's a kiss of death to get the support of the U.S. And what did Condi Rice do yesterday? The first thing, she calls Abbas to express the firm support of the United States. These people are delusional. They don't understand how bad it is for the worst thing that could happen to Abbas is get Condi Rice's support that way. And
yeah.
They're still doing it. Same thing. I think it's, you know, people very often think that there's a you know, refined plan at work there. I don't think so at all. I think they're plain stupid. Imperial hubris is the perfect expression that Michael Shore uses for that. These are completely delusional people. They can't come to terms with the fact that they cannot, you know, terrorize and oppress an entire region and hope to get away with it.
Well, so if you were somebody's national security advisor or something in Israel and you wanted to at least start turning the ship around and start heading toward a peaceful policy, what kind of direction would you advise that they go? I mean, you say there's no good options. There's got to be one or two that are the least worst.
Well, by definition, the first thing to do is to negotiate with the representative of the Palestinian people, which is Hamas. Negotiate with the representative of the Lebanese people, which is Hezbollah, to sit down with these people. Admittedly, they're not going to like that, but that's the people to talk to.
God, I can hear the right-wingers in the radio audience just... ripping their hair out. What did he just say? Recognize Hezbollah as the leader of the voice of the Lebanese people?
Well, the right-wingers have two options. They can rip some of their hair out hearing that, or all of it, by denying that this is the only way to talk to anybody there. I mean, there's nobody else to talk to. Talking to Signora and Abbas is just about as good as talking from somebody from the Heritage Foundation or, you know, some Likud think tank. It makes no sense. There's nobody to talk to.
Oh, man.
A deal with these people is the only way out. By continuing to kill them, you know, they're only asking for a stronger and stronger reaction.
Yeah. Hey, what about from the point of view of, say, the average guy in the West Bank? Would you advocate to him to push to just go ahead and recognize that Israel's never going to give up that high ground? I learned that listening to G. Gordon Liddy. I've never been to Israel. G. Gordon Liddy says the West Bank is the high ground, tactically speaking, militarily speaking, and Israel's never going to give it up ever, so forget it. And, yeah, I'll take G. Gordon Liddy's word for that one. So if you were a Palestinian in the West Bank, the average guy, would you try to accept that that's the case and push for Israeli citizenship and a vote in the Knesset, or would you continue to advocate for a two-state solution, or what do you think is the right way to go from the point of view of the West Bank Palestinians?
Well, if you're asking tactically what the best political decision is,
right, yeah.
You know, I suppose negotiating for a two-state solution makes sense. But on the long term, really, the thing that's left unsaid, and which is at the core of all of it, the Israelis need to accept that the very presence of the State of Israel in the Middle East needs to be acceptable to the majority of the people living there. And if they can't accept that, if they think they can impose their presence there forever by force, they're doomed to failure.
All right. And do you believe that the people of the Middle East, in some form of majority, could be made to accept Israel for the long term if they were to, say, for example, withdraw to their 48 borders and elect Barak instead of Netanyahu next time for prime minister?
Yes. And the reason for that is that I think the people in the Middle East recognize, often better than most people outside the region, that the Israeli government is not the Israeli people. And to fight the Israeli government and the Israeli ideology of Zionism is one thing, but to take the entire Jewish population of the Middle East and force them, you know, to fight for their lives and give them no solution is also a non-feasible outcome. I mean, if that's why Ahmadinejad said, you know, we've got to get rid of the regime in Israel, not get Israel off the map. I mean, people are, even his audience is quite aware of that. These are two different propositions. And, you know, throwing them all into the water is not something that they're going to achieve either. It's just not doable. So it would take both sides to accept that certain things are just not going to happen.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for calling in, everybody. Vineyard Saker, blogger at thestressblog.com. Appreciate it, bro.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
All right, folks, this is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Anti-war radio in Austin, Texas.
From Texas, Ron Paul. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tucker. Good to be with you.
So the conventional explanation for the problems between Israel and Palestine is, partly anyway, the United States doesn't intervene enough. We're not engaged enough in the peace process. Do you buy that? Should we be engaged in that peace process?
Well, I don't think the fact that we're involved has caused the problem as much as I think they're naturally enemies and they're going to fight. They have been fighting for a long time and they're going to continue to fight. But I think our presence there doesn't do much good. It's not going to solve the problem. You know, it reminds me of that statement that Ronald Reagan made in his memoirs when he was explaining why he left Lebanon, in the early 1980s. And he said the irrationality of the politics of that region made him change his policies there. And he brought the Marines home after, you know, and we left. But he just sort of threw up his arms and said was beyond his ability to solve those problems.
But we take a side in the Israel-Palestinian conflict broadly. We send billions to Israel. We also send money to the Palestinians. Right. But essentially we're on Israel's side. Most Americans think we ought to be. Do you think we ought to be?
I think we should be on the side of neutrality and friendship with everybody and not subsidize either side. I mean, in the Middle East, we're strong allies and we subsidize Israel, but we've been propping up the Saudi government for more than 50 years, since World War II. And it sort of fits my argument that intervention doesn't lend itself to a peaceful world, especially for us. We lose a lot of men and women now being killed and a lot of money being spent, and there's no more peace than if we weren't there. As a matter of fact, I think Israel would do quite well without us there. They'd probably have a peace treaty with Syria. They want to talk peace with Syria, and we interfere with that process and say, oh, no, you can't talk to the Syrians. So Israel would have a great incentive to work out agreements with some of its neighbors. Now, the Palestinian affair is a lot tougher than Syria, but I think they've worked out an agreement, of course, with our help with Egypt. But there would be a tremendous incentive for Israel to work with Syria, come up with it, work with the Arab League. I don't think we add a whole lot to solving that problem over there.
A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll finds that 52% of Americans, more than half of Americans, want the Democrats to take over the White House in this upcoming election. Obviously, bad news for you as running as a Republican. But doesn't it speak to the larger trend that shows pretty clearly Americans want more from their government? They expect the government to do more for them than they expected, say, 15 years ago. Yeah. How do you reverse that trend?
Well, I think that's the real contest, because obviously the people that work for me and campaign for me want exactly the opposite. They want to get the government off their backs. And, 52% might want a Democratic president, but that doesn't sound all that strong. I mean, right now the Democratic Congress isn't rating very high. That's a healthy sign that the American people are waking up and they're getting disgusted with what they're getting. So maybe they will come to realize that we need less government, not more government, if they're unhappy. And we can hardly argue that we've had minimal government over these past 50 years. All we do is have an expansion of government. And that fits my argument that we have too much government. We need a lot less.
But your government is, as you just put it, you want government off our backs. You want government to stop interfering in people's lives. But isn't interference the natural consequence of government services? In other words, when someone does something for you, he's by definition interfering in your life. So if you want less government interference, you're going to get fewer government services. You're not going to have government-provided health care, for one thing.
Yeah, you know, this is the whole thing. When you get something from government, that's all they talk about. The politician brags about it, and the people who receive it, they feel good, unless the services don't arrive on time, like in Katrina. You know, the services didn't work out so well. So I think what we forget is are the people who have to pay. You know, there's the other half of the equation. Yes, the people who have to pay, and the young people, especially today, who are sick and tired of the mess and who are inheriting this debt and inheriting this war, they have to pay. So services always come with a cost, whether it's direct taxation, future taxation, borrowing, interest payments, or a debased currency, and
okay,
that is inflation.
Then would you be willing to say out loud into the camera that the people of New Orleans ought to be responsible for building their own city, that it's not the responsibility of the rest of the country.
Well, that's the way it was supposed to be originally under the Constitution. It's only very recent years, in the last 10, 15 years, that it became central economic planning from the federal government. It hasn't worked that well.
So would you support a return? I mean, I guess my point is, if you say something like that out loud, it is taken by most people as callous, as mean. But you'd be willing to endorse a system in which regions or cities or states are responsible for their own disaster relief, and the federal government just says, I'm sorry, we're not getting involved?
Well, I think it's callous and mean to depend on the federal government to go down there and make a mess out of trying to save New Orleans. They did such a lousy job. So central economic planning doesn't work. It's sort of like saying, are you going to be mean and not be a socialist? Aren't you going to take care of poor people and starving people? Well, socialism doesn't work. Central economic planning doesn't work. And, you know, in the past, you know, a long time ago, in the 1900, Galveston was wiped off the map, and they rebuilt, and FEMA didn't exist, and the seawall that they built is still there. So it isn't like it wouldn't happen. It just may happen better, cheaper, and more efficiently instead of federal agents getting in the way, taking the guns from the people, not letting private owners get to their property. I get so many complaints about FEMA once we have an emergency in our district.
Well, you've been to a number, three or four Republican debates so far. What's it like backstage? Who do you like? Who, if you weren't voting for yourself, who would you vote for among the other 9 or 10 guys running?
Well, you know, I have a tough time because my philosophy is strict constitutionalist and anti-war and pro-free markets, and nobody quite fits that bill, and probably one of the reasons why I'm in this race. So it'd be very hard for me to get enthusiastic about anybody who's supporting this war and not reassessing it and making an effort to get our troops home and not supporting the idea that you don't go to war without declaring war and win them and get them over with and be more precise and put more responsibility on the Congress. So I'd have a hard time picking one of them right now.
Well, how about Giuliani? He's the front runner overwhelmingly, if you ask Republican primary voters. Would you vote for him?
I'd have a lot of trouble. I think he's an authoritarian. I think he would use government way out of proportion to what the Constitution
meant. He's an authoritarian? What do you mean by that?
That means he likes to use government force. I mean, he wouldn't mind using some of these laws that have been put on the books since 9/11, the Patriot Act and the rejection of habeas corpus. I think I sense that among the whole group, that they're quite willing. And, of course, you know, the other night we had this debate, or to a degree, a debate discussion on whether we would use a nuclear first strike against a country that has no nuclear weapons, that has not, you know, attacked us, and they're all for it. So that to me is difficult, and yet I feel comfortable as a Republican because I think I speak for traditional conservative Republicans and I defend the Constitution.
Ron Paul of Texas running for president. I appreciate you coming on, Congressman. Thank you
very much.
U.S. troop.
This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And, I neglected to mention my friend Vineyard Saker from thestressblog.com, who called in and gave us his take on what's going on in the Gaza Strip there. You should check out his own blog as well, which I neglected to mention. VineyardSaker.blogspot.com. That's Vineyard and then S-A-K-E-R. So kind of European bird that hangs out in vineyards, I think. Some shit. I don't know. Falcon of some sort. Yeah. VineyardSaker.blogspot.com. And thanks very much for calling in and sharing your view there.
Real quickly, Mexicans! Something's got to be done about the Mexicans. We got to do something about all the Mexicans. Well, the U.S. government has a great idea. Put them in the military. That's right, those terrible, illegal... I'm not against Mexicans, I'm just against illegal Mexicans. Oh, okay, well, what to do with illegal Mexicans? Use them as cannon fodder. Send them to go play the IED lottery in an aluminum Humvee. You know, they'll have a real nice memorial someday. It'll be great. Washington, June 11, 2007. A senior defense official expressed hope today that a provision in the stalled immigration bill that would have allowed some undocumented aliens to join the military won't fall off the radar screen. The Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors, or DREAM, provision in the immigration bill was expected to help boost military recruiting. Bill Carr, acting Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Military Personnel Policy, said today during a telephone conference with veterans group representatives. The DREAM provision, oh God, these people and their acronyms, man. It's like living in a brave new world, I'll tell you. The DREAM provision offered a way for high-achieving children of undocumented or illegal residents to join the military and ultimately become citizens, Carr explained. In other words, if you had come across the border with your parents, yet you were a minor child and have been in the U.S. school system for a number of years, then you could be eligible to enlist, he said. And at the end of that enlistment, then you would be eligible to become a citizen. If you're not dead... Okay, I made up the last part of that quote there. So there you go, those terrible, terrible, illegal Mexicans. The wonderful national government is finding a way for them to redeem themselves by going and fighting for American empire. Can't get Americans to do it anymore. You know, we'll go for American flags and yellow ribbons and chanting slogans and all that for a little while, but not forever. Americans still don't want wars of aggression, really. You gotta call it defense. But, you want to be an American, huh? Oh, you've been in America for years and years and years since you were a little child and gone to government school this whole time and speak with a Minnesota accent or whatever. Sorry, we're going to deport your ass back to Mexico. You don't have any rights. But there's one way that you can take out of this situation. It's called DREAM, which stands for Go Die in Iraq and Never Become That American Citizen That You Wanted to Be. Yeah, great. Also, real quickly, El Baradei, who is the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, says that attacking Iran to arrest the progress of their nuclear program would be madness. And I suggest to the few of you who are listening to this thing that you take the advice I gave you before the Iraq War, which was listen to this guy. To attack Iraq would be madness. Okay, well, replace your Q with an N. To attack Iran would be madness. Says El Baradei, whatever the hell. And he's right. He is right. I've spent I don't know how many shows in the last 6 months here on anti-war radio talking about the dangers of the consequences intended and unintended and on down the chain of cause and effect that could come from an attack on Iran. And now some of it is worst case scenario stuff, but I say, you know, since we get nothing but best case scenario from the war party, a little bit of balance is worthwhile. The leaders of all the most powerful factions in Iraq, as the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Mahdi Army, their leadership have promised that they will turn on the Americans. They are the government of Iraq. That they will turn on the Americans in full force if America bombs Iran, putting our soldiers in terrible danger, the ones that we already have in Iraq, particularly since they are wholly dependent on one supply line through Shiite territory from Kuwait to Baghdad. And I'm particularly concerned because I keep getting emails from a friend of mine whose nephew is over there, telling him that, man, we're running low on ammo, not just food and the supplies that we've been, you know, more or less dependent on. We're running out of the basics. And we're driving back and forth every day through pretty hostile territory here. And this is a serious danger of what could happen to the American soldiers in Iraq if we bomb Iran. Also, I think it's at least plausible, perhaps even likely, that they could sink American ships in the Persian Gulf, perhaps even one of our carriers in the Persian Gulf. They have, well, I'm reminded of the blue versus red war game that they ran before the invasion of Iraq, where an American general pretended to be Saddam Hussein, basically. And in the war game, he had some supersonic sea-skimming missiles, basically. And knowing that the U.S. Navy had Aegis radar and sophisticated Gatling guns, anti-missile defenses, and so forth on their ships, he decided he would just launch every single supersonic sea-skimming missile he had and hope that a few of them hit. And, of course, in the war game, a few of them did hit. And so they restarted the game. No fair. You can read all about this in Andrew Coburn's book, Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And there's a, you know, obvious likelihood or possibility that the Iranians, if we attack, could just do that very thing and just launch every single supersonic surface-to-sea missile, you know, ship killer missile that they have in an attempt to get a few through. And it's at least possible, if not likely, I think, that they could. Also, they have speedboat forces, which obviously are not all that effective, but if they dump, they're basically like PT boats, armored PT boats, like you'd see on, the A-Team or something like that. And when B.A. Baracus soups it up. And they have enough of those to, and swarming tactics, they call it, to perhaps get some attacks on the ships at sea to drop mines, etc. They have the ability to foment unrest with their agents all across the Middle East and probably in Pakistan. And there are various ways that Iran can fight back. To attack Iran would indeed be madness. And according to Mohammed al-Baradei, there's no evidence, no indication even, that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. What they're developing is the ability to enrich uranium to a low level for an electricity program. And despite what John Bolton says, it's not a matter of just flipping a switch and going from low-enriched uranium to high-enriched uranium. And they certainly cannot do it in the presence of the International Atomic Energy Agency and all their instruments and video cameras and inspections and inspectors and everything else. They can't do it. And they're not doing it. The excuse is, we can't let them master that technology to enrich it at all. But that does not equal a nuclear weapon, the ability to enrich uranium at all. And if they were to begin attempting to turn their nuclear program into a nuclear weapons program, they would have to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the IAEA out, and say, we're building a nuke. Everybody back off. And of course, I will continue to argue against war against them at that point, but that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. The insistence is, from the American and Israeli position, not one centrifuge spins in Iran, and we won't settle for anything less than that, even though that is a direct violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that America and Iran are signatories of. Israel is not, even though they have over 400 nuclear weapons, including based on submarines, probably not far off the coast of Iran. But the Non-Proliferation Treaty says that Iran has an unalienable right to pursue nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, and in fact mandates that we help them, as Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and the boys did try to help Iran with their nuclear program back in the 1970s. And again, Let us count the ways. Maybe you can think of some on your own. Count the ways in which attacking Iran would be madness, including how unjustified it is in the first place and what the disastrous consequences could be. America is already second place for the most hated nation state in the world. See if we can make it first place. And of course, if you listen to any of these Republicans or Democrats, like that warmongering psychopath Barack Obama, all options are on the table for dealing with Iran's nuclear program, including if we have to use a nuclear first strike against Iran. That's the peace candidate on the Democrat side. All options are on the table. The greatest threat of our age, Iran. Yeah, right. Iran, what's their GDP? $100 billion? Give me a break. I'm just guessing. I have no idea. Maybe it's higher than that. It's still not a threat to us. As Ron Paul explained the last time he was on Tucker a week ago, they have no army, they have no navy, no air force, not of any consequence at least, and no ability to threaten the national security of the United States. And this whole thing is a lot of hot air. Sounds about right to me. Also I wanted to throw in here real quick for those who didn't hear, Kurt Waldheim, who was a former Nazi and former Secretary General of the United Nations, died yesterday, according to the New York Times. And yes, he was a war criminal, and he was a bureaucrat, a desk murderer, who helped arrange the mass execution of civilians by the German Nazi stormtroopers. And I'm pretty certain that's how he got his job as Secretary General of the United Nations. Had to make a consensus agreement here now. We got to get the communists and the Nazis and the New Dealers, you know, to all come around and shake hands to create the last best hope for peace on Earth. So I'm pretty sure that's how Kurt Waldheim got that out. Second or third Secretary General of the United States, falling in the footsteps of Alger Hiss, the KGB agent. So, rot in hell, Kurt Waldheim, and the United Nations, which you directed. I totally forgot. Scooter Libby. Here's the thing with Scooter Libby. Yeah, he leaked the name of Valerie Plame. Personally, I don't get all that emotionally upset when somebody leaks the name of a CIA agent. I mean, if they get people killed, then that sucks, but what are you going to do? I don't really believe in government secrecy, and frankly, I'd prefer the Articles of Confederation, which certainly would not allow for a CIA, as if this Constitution does. But you got to understand the narrative. See, that's the problem. They never give the narrative on TV except Libby ought to go free because there's no underlying crime and it's not fair that he's been persecuted. But you never hear the narrative from the anti-war party forces. And, you know, I can't sit here and rehearse all the little bitty details of who did what. But, I suppose I could if I decided to sit here and take my notes and take my time and go through it. But the point at the end would remain the same. And that is that Scooter Libby was part of what Colin Powell's aide, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, calls the neocon cabal. In fact, they call themselves that, according to Seymour Hersh and his New Yorker article, Selective Intelligence. They call themselves self-mockingly the cabal, wrote Seymour Hersh. And what this is Dick Cheney, the right-wing nationalist crazy warmonger, and his alliance with the neoconservatives, which are basically ex-communists who became basically agents of the Israel lobby in alliance with the military-industrial complex, kind of cutting the oil man out of the establishment, in a sense, in terms of determining the policy. And this group of neoconservatives, many of them are very directly tied to the right-wing Likud party in Israel, including being parts of the same foundations and so forth. In fact, Jim Loeb has a great article on antiwar.com today, and I know you can't call Jim Loeb an anti-Semite, It's called More on That Meeting in Prague, and it's about the closeness of the neoconservatives in America to the Likud party in Israel. Doug Feith, for example, his father was one of the founders, I believe, of Likud. And basically what happened was, these are the guys who lied us into war. These are the guys who said, man, the CIA is never going to make up a good enough excuse for us to bomb these people. So they created their own little intelligence department in the Pentagon. They put David Wilmser and John Bolton in the State Department to keep a leash around Colin Powell and Dick Armitage to prevent them from really getting in their way. And they set up this little, as Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com calls it, a transmission belt of treason back and forth between the vice president's office, the Office of Special Plans, is what it was called in the Pentagon, and the office of Ariel Sharon. And in fact, according to the reporting of Robert Dreyfus, Julian Borger in The Guardian, Dreyfus in The Nation, Julian Borger in The Guardian and other places, James Bamford as well, Karen Kotowski, part of her story seems to confirm some of these details in terms of seeing Israeli generals come to the Pentagon to meet with Douglas Feith and so forth. But basically, I guess the story, the way Dreyfus sums it up, is that Ariel Sharon was having just as much trouble with getting the Mossad to come up with an excuse to lie us into war as Dick Cheney was having with the CIA. So he actually created his own little office of special plans in the prime minister's office in Israel and end run around the Mossad to help make up the intelligence to lie us into war. They were producing the intelligence in English and stovepiping it directly to the office of special plans, which was then sending it on that treason transmission belt up to the vice president's office. And these are the guys who came up with all those talking points used to whip this country into a state of fear and war hysteria in 2002 and 2003. And Scooter Libby was at the center of this. In fact, I mentioned Karen Kotowski, the retired lieutenant colonel who worked at the Pentagon at this time in the Near East South Asia division, and her boss, Bill Luty, was one of the members of the Office of Special Plans. She was not actually in the Office of Special Plans herself, but her boss was part of it. And she was on the receiving end of these people's talking points all the time. And she observed them saying, ooh, this is a good one. I've got to go give this. I got to get this to Scooter. Come on. Hey, give me that pile of stuff. I guess it was either her boss, Luty, or David Worms was at State at the time. I think it was her boss, Bill Luty, that she said, she heard him say, I got to get this to Scooter. This was that stovepipe of lies going from the lie factory, as Dreyfus calls it, in the Pentagon, up to the vice squad, as Robert Dreyfus calls it, in the vice president's office. And from there to the lips of Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, George Bush, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and the rest of the liars who lied this country into war. And these are war crimes. It's not okay to start an aggressive war, and it's not okay to make up lies to justify an aggressive war. In fact, it's been admitted now, repeatedly, most recently by Michael Ledeen, and you'll hear the sound bites coming up Monday when I interview the director of the new movie World War IV, where Michael Ledeen explains that, yes, see, the thing is, we had to make up all the lies about the weapons of mass destruction because the lawyers said that, particularly in other countries, in Great Britain, for example, they told Tony Blair, look, you could be hung for war crimes if you start an aggressive war because aggressive war is wrong unless the UN says it's okay, right? If France and China and Russia agree to an aggressive war, that gives it moral legitimacy. Everybody knows that. And so, Ledeen concludes, so that's why we told you all that bullshit. And of course, he is part of WE, and I will have the exact quotes and the sound bites for you on Monday. He is part of WE. He was a contract agent of the Office of Special Plans, and worked, in arranging the secret meetings in Rome between Harold Rode and, the Israeli spy Larry Franklin and, the rest of these guys. And, back to the plame. Here's how this all ties into plame. Is they had some bogus intelligence that, in fact, probably almost definitely originated with the Cheney cabal and was, I believe, outsourced through the Rendon Group and Gorbanifar and others to come up with these, or somebody around that group of the neocons meeting regularly in Rome, that they came up with these forgeries that pretended to say that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger. And when the CIA sent a former ambassador named Joe Wilson to Niger to check it out, he came back and said that it was completely bogus, which it was. It was all based on forgeries. And he leaked something to, I believe, Nicholas Kristof in the Washington Post, who wrote an op-ed about it. And then finally, he wrote an op-ed himself in the New York Times called What I Didn't Find in Africa, explaining that they had lied, including the president, in the State of the Union address and claiming that Saddam had this active nuclear program. And so then Scooter Libby was part of the Cheney cabal in the vice president's office and the White House Iraq group that set about to destroy him and destroy his wife for revealing what liars they were. And so that's why it is a good thing that the government is prosecuting and convicting someone and locking them in a cage. When that person is Scooter Libby, he deserves it for certain. And I believe also it's worthy of note the hilarious hypocrisy on the part of the Republicans who say that if it's no big deal, the underlying crime, then there's no excuse to lock him up at all, when these are the very same people who wanted to remove the president of the United States in 1998, a move which I supported for exactly that, lying when there was no real underlying crime, but lying under oath, which it seems to me any member of the executive branch trying to obstruct the judicial branch ought to be locked away and the key tossed away, too. I didn't say that right. Locked up and throw away the key. And yeah, you know. Anyway, so rotten prison for, you know, the very short time that you have to go, if you have to go at all, Scooter. See you in hell, pal. See you guys back here Monday, 11 to 1, Texas time, for Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. No, I already played Minor Threat, right? Hang on a second. I have a favorite. It's a dang old. No, I already played that too. I think I'll play. Well, here's a good soundbite of Ron Paul explaining Robert Pape, and then I'll play a song after that. So I'll decide. I'll pick a song while this soundbite's playing. Eh? Get it? Like that? All right.
Well, Dying to Win is a very important book. Of course, Michael's book on imperial hubris, these are all important books. But Dying to Win is critical because Pape is the only one that has gone back and studied several hundred individuals who committed suicide terrorism to try to understand their motivation. And when I started reading his book, I was convinced that he was wrong on his thesis, because his thesis was that it wasn't religious fanaticism. And, you know, we've all heard that, and I accepted that. So I said, well, I'm going to read it anyway, but I'm skeptical. But by the time I finished it, he convinced me that, you know, religion can't be ignored, and that's part of it, and their religion's different than our religion. But the number one cause was occupation by a foreign power. And he pointed out some important issues. He said the country that has the most suicide terrorism is Sri Lanka. That isn't even Muslim. That has to do with the Hindus and the Indians, you know, fighting with each other. But they commit a lot of suicide terrorism. And the most radical countries that have more radical Islamists, Iran and I think Sudan, they don't commit suicide terrorism. But they came from, you know, Saudi Arabia, that felt like we were occupying. And even there was no suicide terrorism before the Iraqi war in Iraq. You know, it's hard to believe it, but even under Saddam Hussein, there was more tolerance there. You know, Christians live there, and half of them now have been run out of the country.
Right.
So it's the occupation. He's convinced me of that, and we should understand that. That doesn't excuse him. I mean, they're still criminals, they're still murderers, and you know, all these things, and we have to deal with it, but we ought to understand why it occurs so maybe we can neutralize it. And besides, changing our policy shouldn't be a big deal, because it's only changing the policy to what I think is a wonderful policy of non-intervention,
right,
following the Constitution, the advice of the founders. It's very practical. Besides, we can't afford this warmongering stuff that we do anyway.
Certainly.
We're going broke.